Brothers and sisters, I proclaim to you this morning the word of our God as we could read it from Revelation 13. And we'll focus on that second section, obviously, about the second beast. The window I would like to use to access that portion of scripture is the beginning of verse 18, where our translation reads, "This calls for wisdom." But as we heard last week, there's here again not quite what the Greek says. What it should say here is simply the statement, "Here is wisdom." And as we read the surrounding verses, we say, well, yes, we certainly need wisdom. Wisdom's needed here. After all, what is the mark of the beast? What is the beast? What is meant by 666? And we've got so many questions and speculation. What we need to do, congregation, is consider for a moment, what's wisdom? Then Proverbs chapter 8, and you may want to look at that at home, personifies wisdom, pictures wisdom as a person standing on the streets in the intersections of life and telling people this or that. The truth of the matter. In relation to our chapter, what wisdom is telling people in the intersections of life, is this the beast and hence its mark, is not much to be overly worried about, for it's only the size of a man. Nothing like God. And with him, we're safe. So I summarized the sermon this morning with this theme: through heavenly wisdom, the Christian discerns the devious activity of the second beast. In developing that theme, I ask your attention for 3 points. The first is, who or what is the second beast? The second, what does the second beast accomplish? And in third place, where is the comfort? So the first point we need to deal with then is, who or what is this second beast? I do need to remind you of the context. We began our reading at chapter 12, verse 17, for a reason. And you recall from a couple of weeks ago that chapter 12 had told us about the defeat of the dragon. How it is that the dragon was cast out of heaven onto this earth, now in fury, wants to attack the church. Sought to sweep the church, the woman, away by the flood, but wasn't able to. And so the dragon's the more enraged and seeks to pick off individual believers. The offspring, chapter 12, 17, the offspring of the woman. That's what characterizes the dragon's efforts throughout the New Testament dispensation. How does he go about doing that? And we heard last week that the devil, the dragon, has an alliance with that first beast, the beast that arises out of the sea. The beast with the hellish, with the demonic attitude. And we talked about what that beast was, the human heart. Bent as it is against God and in favor of the devil, the human heart, as it bends together people together using force, there's your horns, in order to compel the offspring of the woman to worship the dragon. And we said too last week that this power, this force of the twisted heart of people comes to expression in wherever people gathered together to have their levers on the powers, their hands on the levers of power. You think of government, you can think of big tech, and you can think of Wall Street and so many more. We found this intimidating. But the Lord had said, verse 10, here is the endurance and faith of the saints. He promises perseverance. Well, now we move on. Because the dragon is still furious and wishes to pick off the believers. And the Lord tells us that the dragon has an alliance also with a second beast. This one's from the earth. Earth. Is that part of God's creation? Heaven above where God dwells, earth beneath where people dwell, the waters under the earth. That's the abyss where Satan, the demons are. This beast comes from the earth where people dwell. That's where the portion of creation God has given to man, where all things are under our feet. This beast comes from the earth. Shall we say from our domain? And so there's something appealing about this beast, something our size about this beast. It's from the earth. It has the aroma of humanity about it. Its appearance, then, is also far more attractive than the appearance of the first beast. That first beast, chapter 13, verse 1, had 10 horns and 7 heads. But the second beast, verse 11, is simply 2 horns like a lamb. Now, we're not to think of a newborn lamb, which doesn't have horns. But in the course of months, as the lamb begins to grow, it does develop a couple of little stubs on the top of its head that eventually become horns when it's full grown. Well, now, this beast has 2 horns like a lamb. So we think of something harmless. 2 little stubby growths, still covered in wool. I mean, what's wrong with that? That's the kind of animal you want as your pet. We're also told that this harmless-looking beast spoke like a dragon. Now, our thoughts are not to go to what kind of sound does a dragon make. Does a dragon bark? Does a dragon rumble? Does a dragon quack? Nobody knows. Nobody's ever seen a dragon. It's a mythological animal. But the reference now to it spoke like a dragon is a reference to what it says is deceitful. And I say that because chapter 12, verse 9, had spoken about the dragon, that ancient serpent who was called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. There you have it. The dragon deceives. This little beast, harmless, horns like a lamb. You'd like to adopt it as a pet. Is deceptive. Speaks like a dragon. And then we recall Genesis chapter 3. How the serpent had spoken to Eve in the garden. At first look, what the serpent said sounded all right and factual and truth. But it's all deceptive. It was a twisting of what God had said. And that's this second beast. Subversive in what it says. And we need to know that the human heart, depraved as it is not tuned in to get this deception, to notice it. It takes the Lord to tell us that what this beast says is far less than truth. And further, in the verses 12 to 17, there's a number of action words translated for us as exercises or causes or makes, words like that. But we need to know that in the Greek, it's always the same word. It's always the word does or makes. That's one word in Greek translated either way, does or make. And the point is that through its speaking, this particular beast gets things done. That's intriguing. Our thoughts go back to Genesis 1. God spoke and got things done. Made this world. You see, there's the second beast. Trying hard to imitate God. To put itself forward as God. Act like God. We'll find more examples of that as we move along. But I'd like now, congregation, to pause and ask you this question. Who actually, or what actually is this beast? I mean, as you look in the world of today, who would you point to, what would you point to and say, that's the second beast? What are we to think of? Now, some of you may be inclined to say this second beast isn't that Nero. Haven't we read that somewhere? And the answer is probably yes. Because a lot of common literature is going to equate this beast with Nero. And I want to show you how that works and why that's wrong. How that works? Why people say this might be Nero? Well, if you use the letters of the Hebrew alphabet to write down the words Caesar Nero, then we're told that equals 666. How that works? Look, the children from school, you will know that you can take letters of the alphabet to equal numbers, right? A V is 5, an X is 10, L is 50, C is 100, right? That's how the Roman people used to write down numbers. Well, you can do a similar sort of thing with the Hebrew alphabet and add up these letters, equivalent of numbers now, and we're told that the word Caesar Nero equals 666. Ta-da! It's got to be Nero. And of course, Nero is not living today. He lived in John's day. And so then the thing becomes next, okay, we're waiting for a new Nero. And this new Nero must be the Antichrist. And that thought's out there. And that would answer the question, what are we to think of in today's world? There's a number of problems with this. The first problem is, we can't assume that John's readers, John wrote Revelation in Greek, to people in Asia Minor who were Greeks, we can't assume that his readers knew Hebrew. No more than I can assume that you know Hebrew. In other words, this particular meaning of 666 would be lost on John's readers in those days as much as in today's day. Furthermore, any time that John in his revelation makes reference to Hebrew, the Hebrew language, he says so explicitly. A couple of chapters later, we're going to find out about Armageddon. But then John says, that's a Hebrew word. But perhaps the biggest killer of the argument is, you actually have to misspell Caesar Nero in order to get the number 666. You have to skip a vowel. And so we're back to the question, what are we to think of? Who are we to think of when we talk about the second beast? The key word, congregation, is the word spoke. He spoke like a dragon. This beast is not a person. This beast is an action. The action of communicating, of messaging. And his communicating, his messaging, is inherently deceitful, twisted. He's a master spinning the truth. Now I remind you of what the Lord created in the beginning. A relationship between himself and people. The covenant bond. But for that relationship to thrive, to be real, to flourish, God spoke to people, and people could speak to God. Communication. What God said to people, what people said to God, involves thoughts, ideas, how you see things. And of all of that, God said, it's very good. But there came the fall into sin. And with the fall into sin, the heart of man became depraved. God himself, it's Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, looked down upon the human race in the days of Noah, and he says, the imagination of the thoughts of man's heart is only evil continually. There is such depravity latent in the human heart that every thought is twisted. Even the imagination behind thoughts, crooked, corrupted. And that, of course, played itself out in the communication, in what man says. Be that to one another, be that to God. Communicating the message you share with one another is twisted. It's crooked. How you see things, your analysis of why things are as they are, even describing what they are, let alone why they are as they are. Because of the fall, it's all twisted. It's all warped. And as we talk about it, our nature is to magnify ourselves. Whatever problems are out there is somebody else's, it's not our fault. But we'll find the solution. That's what happens as people share their ideas with each other, their philosophies, their worldviews. We do that individually. We do that as a community. People in government do that. People in Wall Street do that. Spin the truth exactly because of the depravity in our hearts and our minds. It's the stuff of Psalm 12. There's lips that flatter. The tongues that praise ourselves. In our society, we have institutions that specialize in communicating untruth. Shall I mention the education system? The media? They preach evolution. Or maybe communism. Or maybe capitalism. Or maybe pluralism. Or maybe critical race theory. Transgenderism. Etc., etc. Messaging untruth. That, brothers and sisters, is what we need to think of in relation to this beast. This beast doesn't symbolize a person. It does not symbolize an institution. It symbolizes a message, a style of communicating, which is why in chapter 16, when John mentions this beast again, he calls this beast the false prophet. Chapter 16, verse 13. So this beast has been around for centuries, and we notice it today too. So we come to our second point. What does this beast accomplish through his speaking? I mentioned already that there is a number of action words in the verses 12 through 17, seven of them in fact, where the Greek always uses the word does or makes, but the English renders it in various activities. And so, for example, verse 12, what does this beast do? It exercises all the authority of the first beast. The first beast had given its authority to the second. And by its speaking now, what does this second beast, by its messaging, what does it do? It prompts people to worship the first beast. Second half of verse 12. Makes the earth's inhabitants worship the first beast. Furthermore, through its speaking, verse 13, it performs, same word again, does great signs. And I said before, this beast, time and again, wants to imitate God. As God spoke and created, Genesis 1. So too, in the days of Moses, God equipped that man to say things in Pharaoh's presence. And mighty things happened. Plagues upon Egypt. Great signs. And this beast copies God in that regard. Even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. Through his word, Elijah was empowered by God to call upon God to bring fire upon the earth. And the beast says that I can do that too. Imitating God. Our Lord Jesus Christ did so many miracles, great and wonderful signs by his words. The beast says, well, I can outperform that too. It's imitating God. And the result is, verse 14, by the signs it's allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth. so that people say, wow, this messaging, this is great stuff. It gets things done. To the point, verse 14b, that people go and make an image of the beast. That's a reference to the first beast, the one that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. That first beast, that human depravity, we can solve all things ourselves, we shall force our way. And people make an image of that beast. Any structure, really, that celebrates human ability without the Creator. Think of a building. CN Tower. Its message, when it was completed back in 1975, was, look at what people can do. What we in Ontario can do, the highest building in the world. Freestanding. Or think of an institution. United Nations, when it was founded in 1945, what was its point? Look at what people can do. No more war. Peace on earth. Or projects. 1969, first man on the moon. What was the point? Look at what people can do. If we can accomplish this, what else can we accomplish to establish peace on earth? As a matter of fact, the passage continues. Verse 15, the second beast was allowed to give breath to the image of the first beast, that the image of that first beast would even speak. Wow. Talk about imitating God. Genesis 2, he collected dust from the earth and breathed the breath of life into his nostrils. The man became alive. The second beast was likely that too. Why worship God? I mean, who's he? I can do it too. And what's the message that comes through so loud and so clear is we can solve our problems without God. We'll manage. We can build ourselves a glorious future. Because the problems we have in life, the problem is not sin, and the problem is not the justice of God. Instead, the beast says, the problem is religion. Religion belongs in a museum. We've got to crush it. And slowly, country changes, follows the first beast, celebrates human autonomy. We don't need the Creator. And if you don't want to participate, then you're marked. You're marked so you can't engage in daily activities anymore. You're canceled. And may be persecuted and killed, as we'd read in verse 7 last week. And that's what we find so disturbing. And so we come to our third point, so where's the comfort? Well, there's the words of verse 18. Our translation has, like I said, this calls for wisdom. The Greek says, here is wisdom. Here is wisdom personified, standing on the street corners of life and saying to you, don't you be alarmed by the second beast. Don't be alarmed. For let the one who is understanding calculate the number of the beast. What's the number of a man? What's the Spirit saying here? Well, the Spirit's saying, brothers and sisters, man can do so much. Yeah. As a matter of fact, God created man to have dominion over God's world. To the point that Psalm 8 says that you have made him a little less than God. Shall we say on a scale of 1 to 10, God is 10, man's 9? Or might we even say now, since John in his revelation time and again attaches the number 7 to God, where 7 means fullness, 7 means completeness, and man's a little less than God. 6. But man's striving, because of his deceitful heart, is to push through to become a 7. To become God. To be seen as God. He tries. And he tries. And he tries. And he can't get past 6. And he tries again. He can only get to the level of 6. He can't get to 7. See, that's why we get 3 sixes here. 666. Man keeps trying. But he bumps up against the ceiling. 6. Because you're only a man. You're only dust. Oh yes, endowed with many gifts from the beginning. But never more than a man. That's what wisdom says. What God says to you, my brothers, my sisters. Should you be afraid of people, of people's message, of what people communicate, of what people say we can accomplish? Man. It's only a man. You've got his number. 6. Never 7. Never will be 7. 7 is your God, who in Jesus Christ became a man and always remained true God. On the cross of Calvary, the man Jesus, 6, who was also God, 7, crushed the dragon, so he's thrown out of heaven. And that dragon can have his allies in his pursuit of the woman, the first beast, the second beast. But my brothers, my sisters, his allies are no more than man. And so we fear not. And we carry on. Confidence. We're secure in the hands of the 7. God. And the day is coming when every 6, every person will bow the knee in worship of the 7, your God, your Savior.